published in 1989, and after being excerpted in the New Yorker, it was a national bestseller and appeared in 20 foreign editions. His other books include The Age of Missing Information, Maybe One, and Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously. He's a scholar in residence at Middlebury College in Vermont, and he will speak to us this evening on the topic of his latest book, Enough: Staying Human in an Engineered Age. Professor McKibben.
Thank you all very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I must say, though, I think you're going to regret that you invited me. You know, I haven't been in Vancouver for a long time, and I remembered, everyone in the world knows about the sort of rugged and spectacular beauty of this city, but somehow you've managed to keep secret the fact that even a week after the autumnal equinox, the climate is roughly equivalent to Miami Beach. And I'm going to spread the word when I get home, so anticipate a sort of horde of SUVs appearing on the horizon, from Americans eager to check it out. It's a real pleasure to be here, and especially for me to be here in the hometown of David Suzuki, one of my real mentors and idols, and who've gotten to see him a little bit while I was here was a tremendous pleasure, and to get to have him hand me an early copy of his new David Suzuki reader was also a great pleasure. I commend it to you. The question that I'd like to consider this evening with your forbearance may seem to you far-fetched, but I would submit to you that it may turn out to be the pivotal question of our moment in time. And it is this: are human beings good enough as presently constituted, or are we in need of drastic improvement? Technology can make philosophy suddenly urgent. A suite of emerging sciences, first and foremost human genetic manipulation, and perhaps not long after that, advanced forms of nanotechnology and robotics, promise both implicitly and explicitly to create vastly improved in quotes, human beings. I will speak for just a moment to that research. As I do so, I want to begin by making clear that I am not describing most of the work currently underway in the field of genetics, including, I'm sure, much of the work that goes on here. Our growing understanding of our heredity and most of the applications of that understanding are benign, indeed, they're blessings. Genetic screening, the growing ability to tailor drugs to a patient's genetic particulars, the possibility of using healthy genetic material to treat disease in patients, so on down a long list, all of them blessings. But in the last decade or so, there are also a growing number of researchers who want to go beyond these kind of innovations and tackle the more basic task of rewriting in embryo a child's genetic code so as to create a better child. They would call this sort of work germline genetic manipulation. To the layperson, designer babies will do as a descriptor. As of yet, we don't possess either the legal authority or the technical capacity to perform such work, but it may be coming fairly quickly. In the last 10 years, a wide range of other species have been genetically altered in precisely this fashion. We have smart mice, we have giant pigs, we have rabbits that glow in the dark from jellyfish genes that have been spliced onto theirs. Even primates have been modified, DNA added or subtracted, artificial chromosomes inserted and inherited. And so the natural momentum carries us forward. If we could make better human beings by knowing how to add genes, why shouldn't we do it? Asked one scientist recently. And not just any scientist. James Watson, who said that, was 50 years ago the co-discoverer of the double helix, and ever since, the guiding light of the genetic revolution. There's not a panel he has not chaired, an award he has not been given. He's called repeatedly for the early adoption of such germline manipulation for many reasons. Among them, he said, in order to cure what I feel is a very serious disease, that is stupidity. It's not, he explained, much fun being around dumb people. It's not certain that this goal is achievable. The genetic controls on human intelligence appear to be far-flung and hard to isolate. It's also not clear that the goal is impossible. Having produced, say, smarter mice as we measure intelligence in rodents, many researchers think that it's only a matter of time, and perhaps not that much time, before we're able to duplicate the feat in human beings. And intelligence is far from their only goal. There are an endless number of physical variables we might choose to control, from height to eye color. No more ugly babies, Watson has promised. And there are emotional and psychological states to enhance. Consider the prediction of a man named Dean Hamer, the chief of gene structure and regulation at the National Cancer Institute's biochemistry lab, an important position, an important man. In a recent essay for scientific publication, he imagined a scenario set not very far in the future, where a couple, he calls them Sid and Kayla, gather in a clinic to tweak the emotional makeup of their fetus. They pondered the choices before them, he writes, which ranged from the altruism level of Mother Teresa to the most cutthroat CEO. In the end, they chose a level midway between, hoping for the perfect mix of benevolence and competitive edge. Sid and Kayla, however, did not want to set their child's happiness thermostat too high. They wanted her to be able to feel real emotions. If there was a death, they wanted her to mourn the loss. If there was a birth, she should rejoice. Given the strides we've made in the last decade in understanding and controlling the production and absorption of brain chemicals like serotonin and dopamine, such visions already owe as much to science as they do to fiction. And I could multiply such examples almost ad infinitum. As we have come to understand the degree to which that virtually everything we do has at least some genetic influence, the number of targets for enhancement, for improvement, has grown apace. And if the genetic engineers fall short in this work, there are waiting in the wings, equally capable and credible, engineers from other disciplines waiting to take up the slack. The rapidly emerging field of advanced robotics, for instance, foresees a not too distant connection between carbon and silicon that would endow us with much faster, more powerful brains, and so on. What interests me tonight is less the technical details than the spirit animating these visions and this work. Freeman Dyson, the eminent physicist and futurist, relates the story of the first time his five-year-old saw him naked. Did God really make you like that, she asked? Couldn't he have made you better? The only honest answer, he said, is, of course, yes. In fact, these engineers are full of a kind of counterintuitive humility. Myself, I don't much like how people are now, says MIT's Marvin Minsky, the father of artificial intelligence. We're too shallow, slow, and ignorant. We seem to have reached a plateau in our intellectual development. There's no sign we're getting smarter. Has any playwright in recent years topped Shakespeare or Euripides? He asked. In his mind, and in others, the limitations are built into our hardware. Humans can only learn about 2 bits of information per second, he said. So even if we set out to learn 12 hours a day, which I'm sure is the UBC standard, and we pursued it for 100 years, we'd still have acquired fewer bits than we can store today on a 5-inch compact disk. And so, such people contemplate what they would call a post-human future. They call for fast-forwarding evolution through genetic manipulation and through these other technologies. And their visions, on their face, fit very closely with our consumer idea of what progress is supposed to be about. More is better is pretty much our mantra. And so more intelligence, more social stability, more strength, all of these things are deeply enticing. A few years ago, a pair of California performance artists rented space in a mall in Pasadena and opened up a little boutique that they called Gene Genies Worldwide and pretended to be offering precisely the kind of range of services that many of these scientists envision, the kind of upgrades in intelligence and whatever. Their small walk-in boutique was flooded with customers demanding just this sort of work. And customers who were not at all willing to believe that it was a hoax when it was explained to them. So the case that I want to make to you tonight, that we should think twice before embarking on these quantum improvements in human beings, is not an easy case to make. Who among us doesn't want our kids to be more intelligent? Who among us, with teenagers, doesn't occasionally wish that we had more carefully designed their emotional state? Still, I'm going to try tonight to make kind of provisional argument against such improvements, knowing that it'll be a tough sell. All I really want to do is raise a few small doubts in your mind so that you'll pay a slightly different kind of attention to these technologies in the years ahead. Now, the most obvious objections, and I won't spend much time on these, are the practical ones. Say that this sort of technology works precisely as its proponents imagine. One of the first consequences, of course, would be to immeasurably widen the gulf in our world between the haves and the have-nots. Such technology will clearly be confined to the affluent, a point even its strongest proponents readily concede. Indeed, the Princeton geneticist Lee Silver, in a fascinating series of essays, a proponent of these technologies, has written at some length about how quickly and how inevitably it will divide the world into what he calls the gen-rich and the naturals, the endowed and the people unable to afford the endowment. And in his sort of calculation of this divergence, it's a matter of relatively short time into the future before these two branches diverge sufficiently that they speciate, that the members of them become unable to interbreed when we have two kinds of human beings. Given that the gulf between rich and poor, the shameful gulf between rich and poor, already bedevils the world more than almost any other thing we can imagine, this thought alone should be enough to give us a certain sort of pause. And on an individual level as well, practical problems of some of the same sort emerge. One of the interesting things, if you think about it, about this kind of genetic work, say, is that you really only get one crack at it. It has to happen in embryo for these kind of improvements to take. So, you've gone into the clinic with your wife or husband, in order to have your first child. You max out your Visa card, getting the best that you can afford at that time. And then you come back 5 years later to get child number two. Well, what happens in 5 years anymore in technological time? I mean, a lot happens, right? This time, you max out your Visa card and the upgrades are quite a bit better. What's your first child is sort of now Windows 95, you know? And of course, your second child, in short order, is sort of obsolete in the same kind of way. And in fact, every person thereafter exists on their own small island of obsolescence as technology moves forward. To me, though, these kind of objections are not the absolute core of the issue. There are a deeper set of questions yet, which I suppose we could call philosophical. And they center around what happens to human meaning and to human identity as we begin this process of the conversion of children to products, their characteristics ticked off a list in some clinic waiting room. Let's consider some of the reasons that people might propose for such alteration, aside from the kind of reasons of pure competition we've discussed already. A more noble reason might be to allow your child to be more fulfilled, satisfied, happy. In our more is better world, this makes a kind of intuitive sense. That is, we added ability to perceive or remember or upgraded ourselves in other ways. In the words of the Yale philosopher Nick Bostrom, an advocate of various forms of human enhancement, speaking recently to a conference, he said that in the near future, these enhanced people would be able to experience, in his words, orgasms and aesthetic contemplative pleasures whose blissfulness vastly exceeds what any human has yet experienced. But does that line of analysis stand up to examination? I mean, it is intuitively powerful, but I'm not convinced that it is correct. One of the problems with figuring out is that, in fact, we've given very little thought and very little research over the years to the kind of interesting and fundamental question about what does make us happy, what does satisfy and fulfill us. One of the exceptions is an emigre psychologist named Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who in the 1960s in Chicago was working on his thesis, which involved watching and photographing painters at their easels. One of the things that struck me most vividly was the almost trance-like state they entered when their work was going well, he wrote. The motivation to go on painting was so intense that fatigue, hunger, or discomfort ceased to matter. Why, he wondered. Now, a behaviorist would have suggested that they wanted the reward of a finished painting. But in fact, Csikszentmihalyi noticed that as soon as they were done a canvas, they pretty much lost interest in it. Typically, they turned it around and stacked it against the wall, he said. They could hardly wait to start on a new one. Finding out why, finding out, that is, where satisfaction and fulfillment lay, turned out to be his life's work. He studied many types of people who found deep joy in some activity, chess, rock climbing, composing music. All the time he was attempting to figure out where that pleasure came from. Psychology, psychoanalysis, was really no more help than behaviorism had been. Theories of the day, for instance, posited that chess, with its struggle to capture the king, was sublimated Oedipal frustration, while attempting to climb rocky spires was sublimated penis worship, implying some kind of latent homosexuality. Through a long series of ingeniously designed experiments, Csikszentmihalyi reached a different conclusion, and one I think that you may, if you haven't read before, and may find intuitively agreeing with your own experience, that what was satisfying was to be doing something at the limits of your ability and competence, to be completely and utterly absorbed in it. Flow was what he called it, the utter absorption in what you were doing. It had to be at the edge of your limits, but it was entirely relative. That is to say, a 1,200 rated chess player in a competitive game with a peer was as fulfilled as a grandmaster in a world championship was. And neither one of them would have found this flow competing against each other. One would have been too overmatched and the other too undermatched. This theory now widely accepted, makes it, to me, obvious why this sort of notion of human improvement and human enhancement doesn't actually lead you to any kind of extra satisfaction. Imagine the rock climber. You figure out a way to endow him with forearms, you know, three times as strong as he'd had before. And it becomes, you know, a matter then of trivial effort to be able to go up and down this wall, perhaps. But that doesn't yield any extra satisfaction to him. He already could have achieved the same satisfaction in any place else where he was at the limits of where he was. In fact, all you've really done is made it necessary for him to get on an airplane and fly to Yosemite or someplace where there's a really big rock wall that's now equal to his abilities. Worse by far, it strikes me that it might actually begin to interfere with that process of fulfillment, because such enhancement, such improvement, I think, begins the process of undercutting identity. Csikszentmihalyi found that forgetting yourself was a central component of this kind of flow state, that it was those moments when you lost track of who you are because you were so absorbed in the chess game or the cliff or the painting in front of you, that was where the satisfaction came from. And that, I think, is what may be quite fragile. And this is a subtle point, but I think it's a crucial one, and maybe the only crucial one I'll make tonight, so I'll try to make it in a couple of ways. And let me begin with an analogy. Last May, I had the pleasure, sort of running in the Boston Marathon. Did I hope to win? I did not hope to win. I knew, starting, that if all went well, I'd be roughly an hour and a quarter behind the person who won the race. In fact, when the gun sounded that morning, perhaps seven men and seven women began the race with any possible thought of actually winning it. Was it therefore meaningless for the other 20,000 of us in the race? It was not. When I crossed the line in 3.5 hours, half the people around me were in tears. Some of them may have been in tears because they were in pain. More of them were in tears because this had been a very emotional thing. The process of training and then of racing was far from meaningless. In fact, it was full of meaning. It was full of discoveries for each of those 20,000 people about strengths and flaws within their character, about a stronger sense of who they were. They had been about, hard about, the human task, the central human task of self-discovery. But now suppose, and this might actually be a fairly trivial piece of work, suppose someone figures out how to reconfigure hemoglobin cells so they can carry more oxygen. In theory, that would allow you to run the marathon much faster. But so what? Faster wasn't really the point. If you wanted to get to the finish line faster, you would have taken a car. You wouldn't have gone for a run. Instead, endowed in this and sundry other fashions, you'd be left, I think, with at least a little nagging question about whether or not it was you that had persevered through those last few hard miles or whether it was your upgrade. You would be left wondering, to some extent, the degree to which you were still you. You will recall a few years ago that the Tour de France, the great bike race, had become a kind of drug playground, a test of nothing but who had the better syringe. And in that period, it ceased to mean much, to the spectators, and one imagines to the participants as well, except as a source of income. To cite the example of one of your countrymen, what did Ben Johnson learn about himself except that he was weak-willed? Human meaning is more vulnerable, more fragile, than sometimes we imagine. And the athletic example is only the most superficial. Imagine that we, in search of ways to engineer out depression, really do discover methods for ensuring a kind of permanent dose of Prozac. Watson, I should say here, has, in fact, as recently as this year, called for germline genetic manipulation to combat the problem that he perceives of shyness, of people being what he calls cold fish. Well, if you could engineer out depression, that might be a boon of sorts for some. But you will recall, too, that within weeks of the introduction of Prozac, blessing that it doubtless was, many people nonetheless were suddenly worrying and worrying deeply about what was them and what was the drug. You'll remember the book, Talking Back to Prozac, that became an instant continent-wide bestseller. Doctors recommend regular drug holidays, in part as a way of calibrating what that baseline is. But germline changes would be permanent. Indeed, they'd pass on to all subsequent generations. And so, you'd be 16. And find yourself unaccountably happy. And not know, if it was because you were falling in love for the first time, or because this tide of proteins that some pharmaceutical company had installed in you when you were a small nest of cells was making itself fully known. To me, that's a daunting idea. Now, you could argue, and you could argue persuasively, that we're already in this position. The mere fact that we know that we're the products in part of our genetic inheritance perhaps should unsettle us in some of the same ways, make us feel less like the captains of our fate. I can answer only that we have, with some difficulty, I would say, but nonetheless, have managed to see that that level of determinism, the fact that at some level our parents may have chosen each other out of some sense of what we would be like or something, we're able to see that level of determinism as consistent with fate, with karma, with chance. It doesn't interfere with our idea about who we are. It's possible that the same will be true of this infinitely more directed choice making, that we will take it all in stride, especially since it will doubtless come incrementally. Perhaps so, but to me it seems more likely that this really is one of those crucial thresholds that we're about to cross, where everything on the other side tastes different, tastes flatter. Even so, even if you grant me that, it might be that there are circumstances which compel us to cross this line. Goals so necessary or noble that it would be wrong to balk. Much of the reporting work in this book, Enough, was an attempt to kind of answer that question, to see what reasons might cause us to take this risk. The most obvious, of course, is that we need to start down this path in order to deal with human illness, particularly genetic illness. In fact, however, as it turns out, there are ways well short of creating designer babies to address these particular kinds of scourges, most of them simpler, technologically if not philosophically. For existing patients, for instance, researchers are pioneering what they would call somatic gene therapy, the injection of healthy genetic material into patients in an effort to override problematic DNA. So far, the mixed record of such work has both indicated its possibilities and confirmed the technical obstacles that make all genetic manipulation risky. But it proceeds, and it falls very much, I think, into the rubric of conventional medicine, an obvious extension of what we do now. As for genetic disease in the yet unborn, we now have and now use the technology of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, PGD, Couples at risk of passing on genetic illness can, in the lab, unite their sperm and egg to create a clutch of embryos, and then implant those, only those ones not carrying cystic fibrosis or Down syndrome or whatever it is that they're worried about. This work itself causes some to shudder, both for its casual acceptance of the idea that some lives aren't worth living, and for the ways that the technology could be extensively abused. You could eventually rate the embryos for, say, intelligence as easily as for cystic fibrosis. But at the very worst, it still operates within the possibility presented by nature to this couple. It will take wisdom to use it well, and perhaps more wisdom than we have. But if we cross the line into germline manipulation, into true designer babies, then just about everyone who looks at this question concedes that there is little or no hope of drawing any meaningful or effective line between therapy and enhancement. People would simply become plastic. The plasticity of humans would become their salient characteristic. We would, at some level, become lines of code. Indeed, the technologists most enthusiastic about crossing these lines often view the medical applications as an early and fairly uninteresting beginning. It's precisely the enhancement that they're after and that they view as absolutely inevitable. Because it is, they say, in our nature to go faster, to speed forward. But toward what exactly? In an interesting way, we're forced, I think, to confront some fairly deep questions here. What is the goal to which we are speeding, for which we are being enhanced? Now, I am aware that this is uncomfortably close to asking what is the meaning of life, a question that we don't normally address in polite company. But when someone tells you that they want to take us post-human, that they want to fast forward evolution in our own time, I think it behooves us to ask why. Because, says MIT's Rodney Brooks, recently named the head of the biggest research program into robotics, because it will allow us a deeper understanding of what truly we are. Because, says Gregory Stock, head of UCLA's program on medicine and technology, our new biology will allow us to pierce the veneer of inside things and reach the naked soul of man. Well, maybe, but these sound suspiciously like the kind of things that people say to each other in the parking lot at a Grateful Dead concert. The Princeton geneticist Lee Silver, that I referred to earlier, ends his fascinating book, Remaking Eden, by imagining some distant future where his gen-rich have progressed very, very far along their way, becoming as superior to present model humans as we are to primitive worms with tiny brains that first crawled along the Earth's surface. And what do these supreme beings, these supermen, do all day? What is the end point of this enhancement and improvement? He says that they devote their hours to answering three questions. Where did the universe come from? Why is there something rather than nothing? What is the meaning of conscious existence? Well, okay, those are interesting. But I would submit to you that they are no more interesting and no deeper than a whole lot of other questions that one could pose, like, how are you feeling? And can I help you with that? And do you think you could love me too? Trading in our humanity for some other thing is a large proposition and one we should take seriously. The idea that, like it or not, we must move willy-nilly forward into this future, always doing everything that we can do, exploiting every technology that we can develop, that's an argument about human nature. It posits that our nature is mostly the grasping, ambitious part of us, And of course, this is a part of us, a part of our nature. All of us can feel it acutely perhaps, because we've been well schooled in it in the last 50 years of consumer life. But I'd like to end this small talk by suggesting that this is not the only part of human nature. The question, are we special, is an old question. Historians and anthropologists and biologists and archaeologists have tried to suggest any number of ways that we might be special. Tool use, language acquisition. Most of these, on close examination, turn out to be less unique than we imagined. If we are special, I would submit, it's because we're the animal that can choose not to do something that we are capable of doing. The animal that can exercise self-restraint, that can say no. Now, in the past, for a very long time, this has been mostly a kind of spiritual and individual virtue, this notion of not placing yourself at the center of everything. Back at least as far as the Buddha, a kind of long line of cranks and zealots and mystics have suggested that to the extent we make ourselves smaller, we make ourselves more fully human. In all of us as individuals, this is, to some extent, what we mean by the process of maturation, by the process of coming to understand that other people, our families, our children, our communities, are at the center of our lives, at least as much as we are. That's a bittersweet understanding. But the people we admire most in the world are the people we think have taken this process the furthest, have matured the most completely. At least that used to be the case until the kind of cult of celebrity with its emphasis on endless childishness intervened. I would suggest that we may be at the moment when it's time to assert this ability at self-restraint societally and politically, to make it not just an individual and aesthetic virtue, but a collective one as well. Which sounds like a very difficult project, and indeed it is and will be. But you know, there are at least a few halting signs that this is what we're starting to do. Even in the hopelessly bloody century that we've just come through, when our attention was fixated mostly on DNA and on the atom and the rocket ship and the computer, there were other new technologies of a sort that appeared. Technologies which in some ways are much more radical and full of promise. One of those technologies, though we don't think of it in this way, seems to me kind of best represented by the wilderness area, by the rise of a kind of sense of environmental responsibility, the sort of spreading notion that we're not at the center of everything, that there are places and a lot of places where we should figure out how to take some kind of step back. That's a pretty radical and new idea emerging in the last 100 years and to some extent spreading. And another of these technologies from the last century, another quite amazing one, was the invention of nonviolence as a technology for affecting human change, the kind of Gandhian invention that allowed the Indians to drive the British Empire from their shores and allowed in my country Martin Luther King to lead the quite beautiful revolution in human values that came in the 1950s and 1960s. These are technologies that, like all the other technologies, allow for much, much, much more exploration into the future as we understand better how they work and what they mean. These sort of avenues, and doubtless you can think of others, strike me as more worthy of pursuit than the kind of techno-visions that some hold out. They celebrate the possibilities already inherent within us, those things that make us most fully human, and I think are probably the things most vulnerable to the kind of reductionist credo of the techno-utopians. The coexistence of the human as we've known her and these new onrushing sciences, like germline genetic manipulation, seems to me their coexistence to be unlikely. I can't prove it, of course. It's an experiment we haven't yet carried out. But I think we should take with some seriousness the testimony from a kind of unexpected source. The only people who've really thought carefully about this work in the last 20 or 30 years and about what it will mean come from the world of literature, and in particular from the world of science fiction. Now, I had not read a lot of science fiction for a long time until I started working in this book. And I had in the back of my mind that it was still the kind of science fiction of my boyhood, which was a lot of exuberant rocket ships to the stars, happy visions of the future that we were coming to. In fact, it's anything but. It's the darkest, most dystopian shelf in the entire bookstore. Movies like The Matrix and Gattaca are absolutely representative of this genre. And the reason they are, and let me recommend one more superb book to you. Let me recommend one more surprise. Technology doesn't like it when you go on the attack in any way. It's fighting back already. One more superb book to you is Margaret Atwood's new book, Oryx and Crake, which I'm sure many of you have read, but which is an absolutely stunning meditation on some of these questions. These are the only people who have diligently tried the thought experiment of holding the scale of these new technologies in one hand and the scale of actual human beings, their characters, in the other hand, and seeing what happens when they mix. And what happens almost invariably in their imagination is that the scale of one crushes the scale of the other. That this next quantum leap, far from being sort of more liberating for human beings, accomplishes just the opposite. All of this helps explain, at least to my satisfaction, why this seems urgent to me now, even though we haven't yet quite gotten to the threshold of this technology. I've spent most of my working life dealing with problems that you would think of as more sort of classically environmental. The End of Nature, which Dr. Weber referred to in his introduction, which I wrote in 1989, was the first book for a general audience about global warming, which at the time seemed outlandish to many people, the idea that we were, as a species, actually had grown large enough to materially and dangerously affect the something as huge as climate. Unfortunately, you know, my sense of it turned out to be correct. But the book was not mostly about the practical consequences of global warming, grim as those are. It was even more about the kind of sense of sadness that I felt at the idea of a planet where no corner of it was sort of free of the imprint of our habits, our appetites, our economies. Now it seems to me, and here I really will close, now it seems to me that another interesting and beautiful nature is under threat, and that would be human nature. I hope very, very much that we manage not to surrender it without, at the very least, some careful thought. Thank you all very much. that
welcome questions from the audience.
Comments, abuse, whatever you have in mind. Yeah. What I was trying to say in reference to those things is that it's almost, to repeat the question about sort of what, sort of more general questions of health and sort of using these technologies to cure human diseases of various kinds and things. What I was trying to say, and inelegantly, I have no doubt, was that in almost everything you look at, every example you look at, there are easier ways, short of this kind of germline genetic manipulation, to accomplish those goals that don't run the same sort of risks to identity, to meaning that I've tried to identify, that those would. But there is an exception to that. And it's an exception that should be noted, and I didn't note it because it sounds odd enough that it makes people begin to think that this is all kooky. But that exception is, and it's important because it drives an immense amount of this work. At some level, many of the people engaged in it see it as the ultimate goal is as a ticket to a kind of quasi or actual immortality, to a world of bodies that don't age or that are repaired as they age, and hence people don't die. And if you doubt that this is a sort of cogent part of the impetus behind this work, there are many pages in this book devoted to showing that that's so. I'll just try to quote from memory from a man named Michael West, who's CEO of a company called Advanced Cell Technology, the first man to actually clone a human embryo and let it grow to a six-cell stage. He's said that absolutely everything he does is motivated by this notion that people shouldn't die. He shouldn't die and other people. It'd take a long time tonight to discuss sort of all the implications of that. First of all, whether or not it's possible or anything, but even more importantly, whether or not it's actually desirable. Because in first blush, of course, it's only the greatest and grandest old dream of humanity since the very beginning. And on the other hand, all the people who've really thought about it in any deep way have concluded that it's a sort of in our literary history, perhaps the grimmest idea that humans have ever come up with, too. That it leads to and posits a world beyond time, a world that lacks the sort of arc of a human life as we've known it, a world that really is, in certain ways, beyond human meaning. It's, for me, one of the most interesting and fruitful parts of the book, and I thank you for giving rise at least to mention it. Well, that's a very good question, and it sort of draws on the question is, what lessons might the wild world, the natural world, give us that that provide certain insights into these questions? It's a very good question. We were talking at dinner. I wrote a very, very odd book once called The Age of Missing Information, which was about an experiment where I did two things. One, I went and found the largest cable TV system in the world, which at the time was in Fairfax, Virginia, and had 100 channels. And I got people there to tape for me everything that came across it for 24 hours. So I had 2,400 hours of videotape, and I went home and I spent a year watching it. Before that time, I was actually a pretty good public speaker. And the other half of the experiment was that I went out and spent some serious, concentrated, alone time in the wilderness around where I live. And I'm sort of trying to get at the question, what does the world look like through these two different lenses? If each one of them was your source of information, how would you see the world? The lesson that the television slams home hour after hour, day after day, and indeed most of the other parts of our culture too, that lesson is that you're the most important thing in the world. You are the heaviest object in the known universe. Everything should orbit around your, this buds for you, And of course, the lesson of anybody who spent much time out in the wilderness is sort of the opposite. That you're a very small part of something very large and very orderly and extremely beautiful. And that there's something incredibly, to use an overused word tonight, meaningful about that, that it helps put one's identity and life in some kind of real perspective. In practical terms, one of the first things that you sort of notice about the natural world is that it's not, you don't have the same kind of constant desire for more. That, I mean, if you're sitting up on a ridge and you're looking, down at a beautiful, lake out in the woods, and it's, you don't sort of find yourself thinking, boy, it'd be better if there were sort of some more boulders around that lake. It would look even better. There's a kind of sufficiency that comes with it. And that that sufficiency, that sense of enough, of a kind of rightness, is a very, something that is in extremely short supply at the moment. I guess that would be the sort of tip of my answer anyway. Thanks. Do you want, I'm happy to. You it is. Start again, I missed the beginning. We certainly could be smarter about those things. We know all that we need to know. I mean, isn't Mr. Wackernagel, the ecological footprint sort of local product here? I mean, there's no great mystery to this, And if the question sort of is, should we be genetically engineered so that we're no longer a kind of threat to the environment? That seems to me, that seems to be on the one hand a kind of reasonable suggestion, I mean, in a sense, and a more reasonable suggestion, one that people, a sort of even more sort of realistic version of this, one that people have suggested is, wouldn't it be nice if we could sort of remove the human tendency toward violence from our genetic code? All I can say to that is that it seems to me that those things are, that those things end the game in a sense. That the game, the fascinating point of being alive at the moment is precisely in trying to figure out how it is that we rein ourselves in. And we now have, the information that we need to do that, and we're beginning to develop kind of the will and the skills that we need to do it. And the only question is whether or not we'll do it in time, I mean, when you're talking about, say, climate change, look, 100 years from now, we're not going to be powering ourselves by burning coal and gas and oil. We're not going to do it. The ecological cost will be too high. We're running out of this stuff. The important question is, can we make the transition in 50 years or 30 years, or are we going to take us 70 years, okay? all of those time frames are much too short for germline genetic manipulation to be of much help, you know. That is, it would be, even if you could figure out sort of what the, you know, reckless anti-environmental sort of gene in us was, it would take too long to sort of snip it out and raise up, you know, generate. I mean, there's no avoiding the ecological conundrum that we find ourselves in. It's a timed test, the first real timed test that we've confronted as human beings. It's not the sort of the poor you always have with you or whatever kind of other moral test that we've been failing for a very long time. This is a deep practical test that we need to figure out and figure out quickly. Yes, the it's too much to ask me to speak for the U.S. Congress. That's too low a blow.
Did everyone hear that one?
The question was that Margaret Atwood in her new book in Oryx and Crake, part of it is a wonderful and quite funny in parts description of how it is that the pharmaceutical companies will sell these various visions that they dream up, the sort of marketing campaigns to convince people to develop different kinds of designer babies and things. And it really is, it's very funny in a very bleak way. And yes, I mean, in the world as it's presently constituted, the reason that this kind of work would proceed on any huge scale would be precisely to make money, and everyone knows and acknowledges that. And as a result, yes, it's easy to imagine the sort of it's easy to imagine that the kind of marketing paradigms that would come with it. And sometimes you think, well, but people would never really do this, would they? Never really go along. And then you sort of find yourself thinking, well, if I told you, 15 years ago, that a fairly significant percentage of at least Americans would now be injecting their foreheads with dilute botulism toxin in order to ward off wrinkles, you would have looked at me askance as well. The power of marketing is enormously powerful, and it is one of the things that's going to complicate any attempt to control this. I mean, in the U.S. Congress, to use your example, the power of the pharmaceutical industry is so unbelievably strong that they're able to keep all Americans paying twice as much for medicine as all of you are paying. That they're able to carry that off is a testimony to their strength and power, and one of the reasons this will be difficult. On the other hand, on the political question, it strikes me that it's not a foregone conclusion that we will necessarily go down this road. And that's because it really does create strange new political alignments. These kind of questions do not divide left and right in the ways that we're used to thinking. They tend to divide between people who style themselves libertarians and people who have a sort of communitarian view of things. And in the United States, of course, the libertarian perspective is extremely strong, but so is the other. And so it'll be a very interesting battle going forward. And as long as I'm on that topic, just let me say that it's ironic that libertarians find themselves in support of this sort of technology. I mean, the libertarian impulse is a strong and healthy one in certain respects, but it's paradoxical for someone who thinks of themselves as upholding liberty to want to be in the position of designing every protein in another human being towards a specific set of ends. Okay, that's the most authoritarian position that any human being has ever, put them in. Stalin didn't have that kind of ambition for what he was going to do to people. So I think that there are possibilities for this argument developing politically. We shall see. Yeah, the question is sort of talk a little more about sort of the other, these other technologies. These other technologies are not as ripe yet, and so it's harder to figure out where the lines need to be, should be drawn, what particular challenges they represent. But then again, they're not so far off. Take, for instance, this idea of the kind of connection of carbon and silicon, the dear to many people's hearts, the idea that they'll figure out ways to sort of, in essence, implant sort of hard drive in your brain or, you know, something like that, boost mental capacity. We already now have managed to make these kind of connections in the lab in a series of different animals. There are eels in laboratory tanks that have robotic brain that controls an eel body, for instance. So though difficult, the work is not far-fetched or impossible. And in this case, one of the very interesting kind of ironies that you need when you begin to sort of really read this literature and think about it, is that on the one hand, people are, there's a sort of technological vision about how we're going to enhance human beings, and make them better and more. And on the other hand, there's a sort of another technological vision right alongside it about how we're going to replace human beings and make them unnecessary and obsolete. Because we'll be able to design, in essence, machines that can do everything better, or in the words of Rodney Brooks, this fellow who's just now been picked to head this huge MIT program on robotics, the most well-funded in the world, as he says, by the end of this century, people will have morphed themselves into machines. There'll be no real difference. That's where the line in this case is, that's where we're going to have to be very careful of it. The erosion of human identity is slightly different, but at least is palpable if these visions come to that kind of fruition. I think the question is, how would Jim Watson like to engineer himself to make him more appealing? Well, of course, it's too late for him. I mean, you have to do this in embryo. But my sense from having watched him for a number of years is that he may actually think he represents the target to which all else should be, you know, directed. I mean, he's a completely interesting and brilliant fellow, and in many cases, he's acting at least in part as provocateur, I think, when he makes the statements that he makes, but not all the time. I mean, he's very enamored of this vision and has urged people, said recently, even though germline genetic manipulation is, depending on how you construe the law, illegal at the moment, it certainly runs counter to all the guidelines in the states of the National Science Foundation and things. He said recently at a conference, someone has to have the guts to try this stuff so we can push it ahead. He's the most enthusiastic advocate of this kind of work. Do I think that environmental consciousness is growing fast enough to really, you know, outpace our, at the moment, no. Look, at the moment, I mean, David, you contradict me if you think otherwise. I think at the moment where this is a battle we're still losing. You know, that the spread of Walmart outpaces the spread of, environmental consciousness. And one could easily and correctly be deeply pessimistic. In fact, the real reason to be deeply pessimistic at the moment is that the science gets worse and worse with each passing year. When I wrote The End of Nature in 1989, I was confident that global warming was going to be a bad problem. Now we understand that it's going to be a lot worse even than we could have imagined. I mean, the latest IPCC data makes it very clear that the sort of midline consensus for this century is about a 3 degree Celsius increase in global average temperature, which would make the planet warmer than it's been for hundreds of millions of years. I mean, we're we're going into completely weird and uncharted territory and going there quickly. On days when I don't want to be pessimistic, the way that I get around it is by saying that the consumer society that seems so powerful has one Achilles heel, you know, one flaw, and that's that it fails to make us as happy as it insists it's making us. That's its one vulnerability, it seems to me. And whether or not we can figure out ways to kind of exploit that vulnerability in time is, I think, one of the really crucial questions, along with the sort of technological questions about whether or not we're going to get fuel cells developed in time and so on and so forth. There's also this deep question about who we are, what that means. I mean, David has explored it powerfully in books and in programs. And I don't know the answer. I don't know, you know, how it's going to come out. I have no doubt that 100 years from now, we'll have figured out other ways to amuse ourselves than the ones we're engaged in at the moment. I think we're deeper, more interesting creatures than that, that this collection of limbs and emotions and muscles and senses is built for far more than sort of, you know, sitting, you know, watching eBay on the screen and clicking. But the problem is we don't have 100 years, and so it'll be interesting to see, you know, how quickly it comes about. I wrote a book called The End of Nature. You know, optimist, you know, is not really my business. So you're going to have to invite someone else to come give you a more cheerful answer than that.
Yes.
I'm not sure I'm getting your question exactly. Try once. Phrase it one more time. That is maybe the distinction that you're getting at, and I think it's a very profound one. You know, has to do with those parts of our nature or of the nature around us that are kind of capable of being separated out and marketed, and those that are sort of intrinsic, and it's a, you know, one of the kind of parts of the reductionist credo of the world is that sort of everything can be separated out and be its sort of component part and I guess that was what I was trying to get at when I said that, you know, that we're very interesting and complicated creatures. I alluded to this in my talk, but one of the things that many of these people, like, you know, many of the people I was quoting, Marvin Minsky and Gregory Stock and a whole number of other people, are very insistent on declaring is that there's nothing special about human beings. Nothing at all. In fact, often the word that they use to describe our brains is, or ourselves, is meat machine. You know, we are a meat machine. And because, of course, if you take that view of who we are or what we are, then there's absolutely no reason not to engage in any kind of this sort of work if we're nothing other than that. And that's why it seems to me important. One of the traps that environmentalists, among others, have fallen into is the idea that there's nothing special about us either, that in fact we're sort of bad news. The sort of metaphor for many environmentalists at various times has been that we're a sort of cancer on the face of the planet and that might be far better off without us and so on and so forth. That kind of idea sets one up for just this sort of, you know, reductionist idea. And instead, I think it really is necessary to defend the notion that what is beautiful about us in the end is this human ability at empathy, at self-restraint, at identification with the other in the natural world around us. All the things that you know, this long line of, as I said, of gurus and cranks and people that we pay lip service to, Buddha and Christ and Thoreau and whoever else, have all hit upon. But you know, the moment at which we live is an interesting one, because we're beginning to get the same kind of message, not just from people in sort of the brown robes of the pious, but in the sort of white lab coats of certain kinds of science. Not this kind I've been describing, but the climatologists and the, who are saying some of the same things about, for different reasons, about the need to rein ourselves in, to step back a ways, to figure out how to shrink ourselves in certain fashions. To me, it's that nexus of human characteristics that's what's worth holding on to, nourishing, nurturing, much more than our, you know, more obvious abilities to build things, to calculate things, to, you know, fight over things, to all the other things that we're all, in some ways, all too good at. But I guess that's as close, you know, that's a very good and very deep question.
I think we've imposed considerably on Professor McKibben. We might take a couple more questions and then wind up this formal part of the evening. Yes.
This is a very good question. Is there a way back? That is, if we start doing this work and whatever. Let me answer it in two ways. The first is that that some of this work, someplace at some scale, is going to happen. You know, some of this work is too easy to do. Various kinds of cloning and perhaps of genetic manipulation is too easy to do that it won't be done. Already there are teams of people working outside the law trying to clone human beings, for instance, a necessary precursor step to this other kind of work. If they succeed in sort of isolated cases, it's not sort of game over, you know, let's all give up and go along, because for it really to make any difference, it has to happen at least, you know, a large enough scale to really start to matter. That is, there have to be sort of enough enhanced children wandering around that other people begin to feel the need to do it themselves and so on and so forth. And for that to happen, for it to become a commercial venture in that scale, for it not to be, you know, just the work of people like that good Canadian Ray L., the UFO scientist. I went up to visit his compound in Quebec, and it was quite a bit of fun. For it to be, you know, more than that will require a certain kind of social acquiescence. Okay, if people are going to make money off of this, there's going to have to be some kind of willingness to license it, to regulate, whatever. That's sort of one answer to that question. The other answer to that question, the thing that really worries me, is that I worry that if we, in a big way, step over this line and begin this kind of work and really begin altering who human beings are, that we really will erode quite quickly what it means to be a human being, that we will begin to lose precisely those abilities, the understanding, a sense of restraint, of pulling back, of all of that that makes us most fully human, that we will, in the process of turning ourselves into machines in one way or another, become machines, think like machines, lose that particular specialness, and that would be the thing that would keep us from being able to step back from that brink. Yeah. This is a very good question, too, and I've sort of answered the question in technical terms. The question is, where would you draw the line on this continuum of technology, and where, particularly in regard to genetic engineering, would the line be drawn? In technical terms, for me, it's very clear that for the moment, the place to draw this line is at germline genetic manipulation, at inducing heritable changes in someone's genetic code in an embryo that would then be expressed throughout life and passed along. But in a deeper sense, this question of where the line, in a deeper sense, often what people are saying when they ask this question, I think, and it's a very important question because we feel it intuitively inside all of us, what people are saying is, well, what if we'd drawn a line 100 years ago, and not had the sort of benefits of science that we've had in this century or whatever it is? And I should be clear in saying that, even if we drew the line at germline genetic manipulation, there's endless amounts of other science to carry us forward, including science deeply related to our understanding of genes. But it's important to bear in mind that the real question is not, that the question before us is not, do we want to live like people before the scientific revolution began, or do we want, do we want to have stopped progress there, or do we want to go forward forever into the stars? Those aren't the choices on offer. I mean, we are where we are, and no one is suggesting that we need to go live in caves, give up antibiotics, whatever it is. The question we need to ask ourselves is whether or not we've reached or are reaching certain real thresholds that might finally signal to us that it's time to pull back. And I think that we are reaching, this is a good place to end, I think we are reaching those thresholds. I think it's extremely clear that the real message of climate change, the sort of signal that it sends us in the deepest sense, is you've gotten big enough, okay? Your set of populations, appetites, economies, everything else is big enough. Time to rein in, And I think in the same way, the idea that we could even be here talking with a straight face about technologies that intrude as deeply and fundamentally into our humanity, to the extent that the people who advocate them speak quite clearly about moving to a post-human world, about fast-forwarding evolution, about becoming something else, the fact that we could even be thinking about those should be strong signal to us that we're at the door of another one of those thresholds, where it makes real sense to ask ourselves whether our technological grasp hasn't by now grown basically large enough, whether or not we don't, on the whole, live long enough lives and comfortable enough lives and easy enough lives, whether or not it might really be time to look around and say, in a very good and pleased and in some sense contented way, enough. The world we inhabit is enough for us. And that's the kind of radical and odd suggestion of this particular book, and I'm very grateful to you all for sort of bearing with it tonight. It's been a real pleasure to get to discuss it with you. Thanks, Phil. That was good.
Thank you. Let's stay here.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to remind you that next week the speaker will be Professor Earl Durbach, speaking on the theater experience, or why do we enjoy watching real people counterfeiting fictional people. And I'd like to now ask Professor Spiegelman to formally thank our speaker this evening.
Thank you, Dr. Weber. I'm a university professor here, and I thought I would just touch try to draw the talk that we've heard tonight to back to education. An internationally known educator, Dr. Craig Nelson, suggests that there are multiple levels of cognition. These proceed from knowing how to identify facts, understand next how to arrange these facts into hypotheses, then to understand how to set criteria to evaluate the hypotheses, and finally, how to understand the values that are at the roots of those criteria. Dr. McKibben tonight is speaking to us at the highest and last level of this cognition, the level that asks us, who do we wish to be? This is, in fact, an odd question for a living creature to consider, and it may partly explain why it is so difficult to answer. But in a university setting, as Dr. McKibben pointed out, part of the difficulty in answering, even asking the question and certainly answering it, is rooted in the momentum of the technology that we actually create here in the university. And this momentum is a serious challenge to institutions like a university such as the University of British Columbia, which is aspiring to be what is called a Tier 1 research university. This aspiration in itself comes associated with baggage about what the institution will value, what it will drive its strategic planning, and the way it will deliver its education. I should note that this is not unique to UBC, and there are multitudes of reports on education in higher in universities across the world trying to come to grips with these questions. But the thought-provoking and engaging talk we've heard tonight is part of the crucial task of understanding and honing the values that have to be at our strategic planning, not only for where we go, but what we teach. Today, some of you might remember that today is the anniversary of a book that many consider to have sparked the public concern about the environment. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was first published on this date in 1952. That book raised a voice questioning who we are and what the impacts of our activities are. We've heard the same type of voice tonight from Dr. McKibben, and we're deeply grateful. Thank you.